This is Peacemaking, or the title, I guess, is Peace on Earth. And this is Christmas in July, 1986. My name is Rich Anderson, and this is my wife, Margaret Anderson. And I thought maybe as kind of a forum for discussion, I'd introduce and say a few things about what we thought about talking about. Margaret has a few things to present, and then we'll let you take it from there. The topic, Peace on Earth, obviously is something that comes to us at Christmas time. We sing the songs, we talk about that. And I think in a lot of other ways around Holden, we hear about, for example, last night in the Village Center, when Barbara showed her slides about South Africa and was talking about finding ways to come to a peaceful reconciliation of the apartheid situation there. Often and quite regularly, I'm confronted with situations in our entire world where there's strife, where there's fighting, where there's terrorism, where there's war. And I think for me as a Christian, finding a peaceful alternative or working towards peaceful living is really the goal. Gentle justice is our topic this summer, and I think that again talks to the issue of living together justly in peace, caring for one another, mutual respect. I think in our forum this morning, what we'd like to do is challenge you, challenge all of us, to not only think about the fairly common ways that we see people in our world working for peace. By that I mean typical peacemaking efforts are often seen as demonstrations, peace marches, peace walks, letter writing campaigns, boycotts. And I think that all those efforts are excellent, they're all good. They involve a lot of people in the effort. But one of my concerns is that I believe most people in our country don't get involved in those efforts. I think that for a lot of us, those kinds of things just aren't our thing. I can't speak for you, but I myself am not sure that I'd always be comfortable going down to the state capitol and marching or picketing. Or I myself, in a sense, have done some letter writing, but sometimes I get a little pessimistic about how effectual that really is. Although I think those efforts are good and I think they accomplish many significant things, what I'd like us to struggle with is how can we, as persons and individuals, work towards peace at home, in our neighborhoods, in our congregations, in our cities, in our country, in the world, ourselves. What can we as individuals do? What other alternatives are there that are maybe new or creative or different that we can do to contribute to the overall effort that maybe aren't the traditional forms or the standard ways or the most publicized ways of waging peace? And I guess I'm optimistic enough to think that if we brainstorm, if we throw out lots of ideas, lots of possibilities, some of us are going to come up with some new thoughts about things that we would like to do or that are fit us and our personality that we could feel like we're contributing to the overall effort. One of the things I think that's an interesting option and an alternative is what Margaret has to present. She's been interested in looking at relationships with parents and children. And what she wants to talk about is peacemaking with little children and parenting kinds of styles. And I think that's one place where it's close at home. You live with your children, your parents, you model behavior. That's one place where maybe peacemaking can take place every day. So I'll turn it over to you. And then when she's done, we'll just throw it open to discussion.
Merry Christmas. Gandhi did say we have to start with the children when we're going to try to become a peaceful world. And we do live in a violent society, and peace is more than of a dream than a reality. My fear is we're raising a generation of children who are so surrounded by everyday violence that's taken for granted. And that's the way we solve problems. And that's a way of life. And just how desensitized are our children. I have some ideas today of ways we might help create a sense of peace and justice for children, whether it's in our own homes as parents or teachers or kids in your church or whatever. There are things that we need to be aware of. They are kind of general and maybe not real earth-shattering, things that maybe we all think about, but to actually live it every day is really tough. And to cultivate it in our homes and with the children we're around, we have to keep it in our minds at all times. Sonia Johnson has said we've become an adapting society, and I think as parents, that really is the easy way. And it's going to take some work. I've got a lot of resources here, and they're all from the bookstore, but one of the major ones that my suggestions are going to come from is called A Manual on Nonviolence in Children by Stephanie Judson. And it's just full of ideas and ways that you can create an atmosphere, at least for your kids to live in. And I've got a lot of them. A lot of it begins with the child's own self-esteem, and I've heard that a zillion times, but it's really important. If a kid doesn't feel good about himself, he doesn't feel good about others, his neighborhood, his world, it just multiplies. Judson says you have to cultivate a good home life, obviously. She gives five elements that we need to have in a home where children will learn to be peacemakers. One is affirmation of each other. Two is sharing of feelings, information, and experience in order to learn to understand others. Three is a supportive community that allows people to work together on problems. Four, practical experience for children on different ways to solve problems. And five, a sense of enjoying life together. A home where these are experienced develops in children a sense of well-being and wholeness, one that contradicts the feelings of helplessness and powerlessness that pervades the modern world. And that all returns to self-esteem and affirmation. And if you feel like the bomb's going to drop on you any minute, your children are also going to feel that way. And we have to feel that within our own little selves, we can work against that feeling. One thing she emphasizes as a real important way to do this is to join a parent support group. You cannot just all by yourself in your home be a peacemaker in today's world without your children feeling like oddballs and you floundering and feeling very frustrated. You need a group of other people of like minds that create an atmosphere to nurture an individual's ability to work creatively on this sort of thing. one family is good, but several families together can make it fun and come up with a lot of good ideas. When parents have an opportunity to draw on a nonviolent atmosphere in which to share, they are far more likely to create and model that for their children, too. Real obvious, of course, is to provide a good example. Sounds easy, but we tend to give double messages to our kids, just like the world gives to us. We arm the children, give them guns or toys or whatever, and then we tell them, now don't shoot anybody, don't hit anybody. And sort of like, let's build the biggest and best missiles, but we're not going to use them. Kids can't decipher those messages. We need to be the kind of persons we want our children to become. Can't just mouth this stuff. We have to live it. Unless we believe an ideal is important enough to incorporate it into our lives, it's doubtful we'll be able to teach it to our children. A lot of that is how we handle conflict in the home, how we react to it in the community, and how we relate to a violent world. So it's important to constantly be aware of those things in our own lives, because the kids are watching and they are modeling. A real important thing is to help children experience forgiveness. To be encouraged to become peacemakers, they need to experience forgiveness from their parents when they make mistakes, and also then learn to forgive others who wrong them. And that happens constantly in a kid's life. It's only as they learn to exercise and accept forgiveness that they can acquire the knowledge to become reconcilers in the conflict situations they meet later in life. An obvious one, and one that is a biggie for me, I guess, is the war toy issue. And I picked up a thing this Christmas on No More War Toys. We're from the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, and there are a couple groups there, Friends for a Nonviolent World and Women Against Military Madness, who were making a concentrated effort at Christmas time to encourage people not to support the toy industry in the respect of buying war toys. Because every time we purchase a toy, we communicate our adult values to the child who receives the toy. Through play, children imitate our values. Do we want them to think that war and other forms of aggression have value by giving them toy weapons? We want to promote giving gifts that promote constructive rather than destructive behavior. You give a child a gun for Christmas, he's not going to want to make a cake with it, or what he's going to do is go out and start pretending to shoot somebody. And what is the point? This past Christmas, the particular targets especially were the Rambo doll and the G.I. Joe dolls. They present a glorification of violence and also teach that people who are different from Americans must be dealt with violently. Interesting thought. And they portray a simplified view of the world. It's good versus evil. And you kill off the evil and then the good remains, and that is not realistic. Research shows that playing with toy guns prompts aggressive and antisocial behavior. Children associate guns with violence, and their play on gun themes generalized into other aggressive activity. and it accelerates. You just watch kids. Christmas Day, we had two nephews we hadn't seen in about a year, 3 and 5, come to the front door, and we said, "Merry Christmas, come on in," and they both came in armed to the hilt. One had a shotgun and the other one had a pistol, and they just came in and shooting their way into the house. And it was not pleasant. No, we had them lay down their arms, and the next thing you know, there they are racing around, shooting everybody in sight. And it was just the incongruity of it all, to walk in the living room and there's the Christmas tree and there's a shotgun on the floor. It was real difficult, and of course we weren't the parents, and I know we tried to disarm them. We finally did, kind of in our own way, but it was something we had to deal with all day long. You know, peace on earth.
Peace on earth, bang bang, you're dead.
Another one that is maybe is harder than war toys because it's harder to control is the violent entertainment we have all around us. And of course the television is in the house, and there you have it. And the scary thing is the programs always present a violent solution to every problem. You know, there's always a conflict, otherwise it wouldn't be drama, but it's always got to have a violent solution. Something as seemingly innocuous as a Bugs Bunny cartoon. Just try it some Saturday morning. They are chasing each other around and tying them up on railroad tracks and beating the heck out of them, and that's all in the name of Saturday morning fun and games. And the other side of that is that there are no consequences to that violence. You know, Bugs Bunny always gets up and is fine, doesn't have a scratch on him, and that's not true. Your kid ties somebody up on the railroad tracks and there's going to be real consequences. And I think it's difficult for kids to disassociate that when they're seeing it day in and day out. How do they know the difference between reality? And I think it's real scary. And the fact that we can say, well, you can't go to this movie or that movie. No, you're not allowed to see Rambo. You're not allowed to see Rocky IV because we don't want you to see Rocky beating a Russian to death in the name of the sport of boxing, is fine, but then you find out a couple months later your child is playing at the neighbor's, and that's what they did for the afternoon, sat in front of the VCR and watched Rocky IV. And that's going to happen, but you can take a stand. So they know where you stand. When they see this, they're going to look at it differently anyway, and they're going to come away realizing that you don't approve, this is not the way you would like to see things happen, and at least make them aware. Another one that I think is appropriate for Christmas is de-emphasizing possessions. And of course, at Christmas, whoever gets the most toys is the best child, isn't he?
Wins.
Much of the conflict in our world is about who owns what. And toning down the need for possessions will take away much of this source of conflict. You know, more is better. I've seen it here on a t-shirt, and I saw it in Seattle on a bumper sticker, something about the kid with the most toys wins. Or no, is that
right?
He who has the most toys wins. And there we are in winning and losing, which is another point. We need to tone down war expectancies. Worries and doom predictions can be self-fulfilling, and it's too scary for a child. You ask any kid, and chances are, I can't remember the statistics, but they don't expect to grow to be old. They expect to a nuclear war, and maybe there will be, but let's not have them live under that cloud for the rest of their lives. Let's have them think that it is possible that that won't happen. And we can help them to be peacemakers by not teaching them that war is inevitable, and there's something we can all do. And we need to talk about war and peace and what it means, and war and what it does, and what's happening in the world in those respects, and on the international scene, and the conflicts that are going on. It diffuses the subject for children, and it also gives them a perspective on what attitudes to take towards these situations, because they're going to hear, you know, we got to kill those dirty commies or whatever, and we need to talk about that at home so they have a different perspective and realize that killing the enemy is not the answer, and maybe there isn't an enemy. We need to stress cooperative play, and this is an interesting one. We have, in our Western world, overstressed competitive activities, as you might all have noticed. Our competitive sports do not make for peace-mindedness. There's much feeling about winning over some other person losing. Cooperative players in an orchestra make better music than competitive players, and a spirit of cooperativeness also is less likely to lead to conflict than one of competition. And this is kind of exciting because we are finding ways now to do this. In Minneapolis, somebody wanted to get their kids involved in some of the park board activities, and there wasn't one thing available that wasn't a competitive activity. So this woman went to the park board and said, there are lots of things that can be done with kids or with kids and parents that wouldn't have to be competitive. Can't you provide at least one activity? And they said, we don't know what you're talking about. We don't have money. We don't have time. If you want to do it yourself. And so she did. She and her husband wrote up a little program and got it organized and are presenting it. And these things are starting to happen. And the bookstore has some of these books, more new games. And these are all non-competitive type stuff. Things that can be done that are really fun and that kids will enjoy. You don't have to always win and somebody always lose. Hopefully we'll do some of these this afternoon as families or kids or whatever. Another thing is telling stories. Children love stories, and the problem is the stories that they like. We have a 9-year-old boy, and his favorite kinds of things are He-Man and
I don't know how many of you have children, but these little He-Man guys are real popular, and they're basically a whole story around the good and the bad. And they're all built on the physiological basis of a muscular, weightlifting, macho man image, and it's He-Man. And then He-Man fights against the other people. And there are lots of little, I guess it didn't come on. Lots of little things. This guy is called Whiplash. His tongue comes out, you know, and that's how he kills people. Tongue lash?
Get this right.
Tongue lash or, yeah. These are a big popular item, and you get 20 or 30 of these little things, and then you set them all up, and then you destroy the other guys. It's a good example. Let me take one of the other ones here. A couple of these other little finger guys, I guess we didn't get the other one down, but these are a couple little wrestling puppets. and they're supposed to fight against each other. You stick them on your finger and they fight. I think they're pretty much modeled after the last Rocky movie, Rocky IV?
No, what they're just wrestling.
They're just wrestling. Okay. Well, this guy's got USSR on his chest and he's in red. And the other guy looks like, he's a big black muscular guy and looks like, who?
He's Junkyard Dog,
that's the wrestler. But what's real interesting is that there are two muscular wrestlers fighting each other, but this guy's got USSR in his chest. And what are we telling kids? Is it, you know, the good guy against the enemy? And the enemy's another country and another culture that's red, and that's USSR. And I, you know, I'm real concerned about it, what it tells children about other cultures, that we're right, and anybody different from us is the enemy to be destroyed. Here's a couple other little G.I. Joe men. You do these too? You've seen G.I. Joe men, I'm sure. Tons of these guys around. All their whole mission is to destroy, seek, destroy, and kill. Well, let me do this one. The other thing I think is real interesting, I spotted this in the grocery store and we had to bring it along. I don't know how many of you buy grocery cereal.
We did not buy this. I'm going to disclaim that right now. Someone gave us this box. I refused to buy it.
It's good.
It's good. This is for sale in your grocery store. And I'd suggest you go and buy lots of boxes of these, so as soon as your kids get up in the morning and they sit there bleary-eyed at the breakfast table, you shove this in their face. And on front is, it's G.I. Joe Action Stars. G.I. Joe, of course, is on the front, and it's fortified with 9 essential vitamins and minerals. And down in the bottom, there's a Kano Action t-shirt offer on the back. And what a... You look to the back and it talks about G.I. Joe Action Mission, and there's a little story about destroying the enemy on the back you can read while you're wolfing down your sugar-coated cereal.
Before school, this is going to inspire you for the day.
Right. And here, the young boy who looks like he's 10 or 12, gear up for action. And he's in a karate chopping position, ready to go to school and kill his school teammates. Right. And then here's a little bit on the side here for parents who are concerned about their children. It says, nobody becomes an action star without complete and proper nutrition. That's why G.I. Joe Action Stars brand cereal is a wholesome blend of wheat, rice, oats, corn, packed with 9 essential vitamins and minerals. You'll feel confident knowing G.I. Joe Action Stars buttered toast, milk and fruit juice make a complete and balanced breakfast. Well, so does all of that without G.I. Joe Action Stars. And best of all, this vitamin fortified goodness comes in an Action Mission box for your Action Star will find exciting enough to ask for. It's a good reason to make G.I. Joe Action Stars the strategic first step in your Joe's mission every day.
Could we write to that company and say, hey,
I'd suggest you absolutely never buy this stuff.
Well, yes, but do write and to the company. And the same with these toys, like the Rambo doll was made by Coleco. Uh-huh. And you can find that in the store, in the packages, what company makes them. And they, in Minneapolis, had a petition at Christmas for people to sign, to send to Coleco to object about this stuff. And who makes this?
Ralston Purina.
Yeah.
I would suggest that you write them and say, until you stop this violent form of brainwashing our children, I'm not going to buy anything from Ralston Purina. You know, we talk about economic sanctions in South Africa. What about economic sanctions at SuperValue? I think it's
Safeway
the same thing. Safeway, I'm sorry.
Okay, as long as we're at it, there's one other thing that really was insidious this year that kind of crept into our house in the guise of humor. And I'm really offended by it because some genius somewhere dreamt this up to make a lot of money, and then some company actually said, hey, this is a good idea, we'll make a lot of money on this, and they made cards and put a piece of bubble gum in it and sell them for a quarter, and children buy them, and then they trade them. and they are horrible things based on rhyming a name with something. For instance, they're called Garbage Pail Kids, based on the kind of a takeoff on Cabbage Patch Dolls. They all have round faces, but things like Creepy Carol, and they're sick is what they are. There's I don't know if we have the real worst ones, but things like Death Beth, and there's this dead person, and the children think they're funny. Here's Busted Bob, whose arms and legs are off.
There's a certain age where clip down humor is really
This is sick, and it's not to be encouraged. And I'm appalled at how much money one of our children spent on these.
Read the backs too. This one says, "Know-it-all license presented to when you write your name. This license entitles the bearer to give his stupid opinion at any and all subjects." It says your opinion is stupid, of course. "Upon no circumstances are you to be contradicted, since you are the world's greatest authority on nothing. Signed, You Are Boring, founder of the LWSS, Long-Winded Speaker Society."
And these are telling
our kids they're boring and their opinions are no good.
These aren't even as bad. Some of them are really violent, but what bothers me is how subtle that is. And I don't know. You just have to. It's difficult. You've got to be aware at all times because it's all over the place, and just got to keep pointing these things out to your kids. You can't protect them from it, but you do hope that they understand the difference, I guess. As far as telling stories, in order to become peacemakers, they need to have a sense of belonging to a history of peacemakers so that they can see peacemaking as being as heroic as making war. Now, we all know the great war heroes, including G.I. Joe, our favorite. But history glorifies the war maker as a hero, but hearing stories about peace heroes can help them see that often peacemaking takes even more moral courage than waging war. And these stories can help them realize that peace can be just as much a cause for which to live and die as is war. And there are some wonderful books, wonderful children's books that can be read to the children, can be given as gifts at Christmas instead of the bigger and better, more violent toys like Sadako and the Paper Cranes. There's a whole series of peacemaker books, for instance, Clara Barton, The Gentle Warrior, and they're written to make them interesting to children. Anne Frank would be another one. I picked up a couple in the bookstore today. Here's a book for children on Thomas Merton, which would be a real fun thing to share with your children. Such a unique person. And a children's book on Dorothy Day and Francis of Assisi. And these gentle people, they're out there. Why aren't we bringing them into our children? Why do we have to give them what's advertised on television? Why can't we dig out some of these more interesting people in our world and our backgrounds? While we're talking about books, this book has been around for a while, but it's a wonderful book to share as a gift, pointing out the differences of people all over the world, the incredible differences, and then acknowledging the sameness of us all. And it really is a nice book. If you ever wanted to give a nice present, a new baby, it would be a wonderful present for a new baby, too.
What was the title of that one?
People. Just people.
By Speer, S-P-I-E-R.
Another one would be to encourage autonomy in our kids. They need to be encouraged to be persons on their own, and for us to stand back and let them experiment on their own and think for themselves. This autonomy gives a child not only a sense of competency, but also one of social responsibility. And a real interesting one has to do with conflicts. And there are books and information on dealing with conflicts. But I thought this was interesting because not only must they be taught not to use violence as a solution for their problems, they must also be led to see that sometimes they can create violence in others while they apparently remain nonviolent. We've all got at least one of these. Conflict is not handled creatively. It can develop into violence in others. Children are adept at this. They will not fight themselves, but they will provoke a playmate to fighting so that he or she gets pushed. To be prepared to be peaceful citizens of the world of the 20th century, American children are going to have to be taught to recognize when they are provoking another person or nation to violence. Barbara Stanford has written Peacemaking, a Guide to Conflict Resolution for Individuals, Groups, and Nations. She says they will have to learn to take responsibility not only for fighting first or shooting the first missile, but also for creating the conflict which led to violence or refusing to deal with the conflict before it became so desperate that it led to violence. That's speaking globally, right on down to two kids in the backyard. Elizabeth Crary has written a good book called Kids Can Cooperate. And power is a big issue, and it's one reason one kid will bug another kid. And we need to help them to want to use that power to make others feel good. There are two sides to that power issue. Have a lot of peace materials in your home, and it's out there. You can find pictures, you can find books. Have it around, share it with the children. That's real important. Also, expose the kids to international experience if you can't take them to other cultures, which a lot of us can't. There are other cultures within your cities, or through books, and have them understand that there may be differences in what we eat or how we look, but basically people are people. And there are also ways, like Barbara talked the other night in Vespers about the letter writing. If you write letters or would like to start, why don't you do so? And why don't you involve your kids in it? There are issues they're concerned about. They can either, if they're too little, they can dictate it to you, or you can help them write it and sign their name, and they're apt to get a response depending upon whom they write to, but express an opinion. And there's lots of places to write and lots of resources available. I do have some a sheet on principles for involving children in social action, and that's really how to cultivate the atmosphere. So your child, if you were really involved and wanted to demonstrate, Minneapolis, a big thing is the Honeywell Project, and whole families are down there at various times. And if you were going to do some of those things with your kids, then you would want to develop a background and an understanding with them. And I have some stuff on that, but maybe we'll wait and see if you have any things to say about what I've said thus far.
I see that you have two copies of Parenting for Peace and Justice up there on the fireplace. I have found that book to be very helpful, and just browsing through the table of contents helps, you know, if I haven't read the book in several months, just going through the table of contents refreshes my memory as to some of the things that I intend to be doing.
That's probably one of the basic book for, if you were going to start, you should maybe get this book and read through it. And it's really is a great background of how to develop the...
And I just wanted to also comment on, or second what you said about making sure that you're not alone in it. Because it's just as important for adults as it is for kids to seek or help build a network of support so that on your most discouraged day, there's someone in your community, your family, your church, your neighborhood who can keep you going.
Mm-hmm. And there's more of that than... It's a growing thing. I think that's encouraging. You're going to find people are out there who are interested in this. Mm-hmm.
A couple of little things that we've done that I was going to add. One was on the subject of war and nuclear war, fear of nuclear war. We've tried not to make the kids feel like they're going to die, like you said. Oh, I agree with you, said, but we also talked about how we, as a group of adults and children in our are trying to work against war, and we do things against war, so that the reason for activism is so that we all remember how important this is not a war, and how we teach other people how important this is not a war, so that they feel like there's some things they can do, and that we're all doing, and that when we say scary things about war, we also always try to balance that with things that we do to make sure it isn't war. And another thing was that I got mad at, really mad at Katie once when she was 3 and slapped her butt. And that was the first and last time she's been hit by me or a parent. And the next day she hit a kid on the playground. She had never done that before. And I had to work maybe 3 weeks of work to undo the damage of that one slapping of the butt. I mean, if I'm going to make, say, might makes right and force is the way to enforce, then she's going to carry that message on to the next person. And so it really didn't pay at all to do that. It was a mistake. And I think figuring out ways of firm control and discipline without violence is a real important thing for us to continue to work on. We teach the children that they have to talk through their problems and they have to, that they can really get angry and they can really disagree with people, but they can't use violence. Violence is not okay. That's a different way of disciplining than.
In regard to your comments on the nuclear war, this is another good book by Dr. Helen Caldicott, Watermelons, Not War, a support book for parenting in the nuclear age, which has a lot of stuff. And there are little things you can do with kids and background information and just helpful stuff. There's lots of stuff out there to help you in this.
You had mentioned the letter writing before, the Lutheran Peace Fellowship. I don't have the address of it. I don't know if some of you are aware of it.
The director's coming up a week from tomorrow.
Oh, great. They had, before Christmas last year, they advocated letter writing on the rainbow situation. Mm-hmm. And they had the addresses and to whom to write, and they had some bizarre responses from the company where they had asked the company who was going to make this, and their justification for it was terrible. So they advocated letter writing at that particular point. With regard to, a lot of us do feel alone in what we're trying to do, and you had mentioned before, you just, you know, you might not feel totally comfortable just going out and demonstrating. But every once in a while, that's a real reinforcement, because you do meet with a lot of people who feel the same way you do. About 2 or 3 years ago, in the middle of the Euro missile crisis, our Coalition for Nuclear Disarmament in prison in New Jersey took several busloads down to Philadelphia. And I'll tell you, it's an inspiring feeling when you see a candlelight parade of 15,000 people marching through the streets and meeting, and then hearing international speakers speak on the thing that you're interested in peace, and you go away from that feeling, hey, you're not alone. You might be alone in your own community, but it reinforces you, and it really makes you feel better.
Charges you up, and I think it's more difficult on your own street, maybe, as a parent, to be different. And that's why having a local parental support group or family support group or whatever is so important.
Is that for us? Ingrid, is that for us to quit?
I haven't any idea of that, though.
Okay. We violate anybody's rights if we don't leave? You can leave if you choose to. Let's go ahead.
I just wanted to share one of the things that our family did that in some ways was a mixed blessing, a blessing that we had to work at in some way. Chose to in apply as a low-income family to have our children involved in Head Start follow through. And because we wanted a multicultural educational setting and also really liked the educational model that program was using. But part of the mixed blessing of that is that while the kids then do have that multicultural experience, is that a lot of time, at least our experience was, that they were exposed to kids who are exposed in their homes to a lot of violence, who use it on the playground, dad wings around, beats mom up, you know, that sort of thing, who get the G.I. Joe toys, and that sort of thing. But it also then, we had to talk about that. Our one son, I think, he can't stand it when my husband and I have harsh words. Because I think he's so afraid that maybe he's so familiar with all the single parent families that he's afraid that if we have one argument we'll divorce or something. But that also has provided us with opportunity to talk about how we need to talk about our bad feelings, and that, you know, it's okay for us to be having this conversation. So I think
plus
in a lot of ways it made our life more difficult while it was.
But that is life, and if your kids aren't going to experience that at this point in their life, someday they are going to, and they're not going to be prepared either.
The other thing I just want to say real quickly is that when my kids were younger and I had chosen to stay home at that point, I felt that I was doing a real intentional job with some of these things. And later, when I went back to work, I started to feel guilty because I wasn't doing so many of these things. And now that my kids are older and beginning to write papers in school and things, it's been very reassuring to me to realize how much a part of them that is when they write a paper for Martin Luther King's birthday on I Have a Dream and things about the environment, and it includes things about justice and peace. They go, hey, you know, you did such a bad job after all. I don't have to do this. You know, sometimes it's the little things that I don't even think about doing, you know, like not buying those toys, that really do make a big difference.
It is. It's subtle. I know our kids, well, I played Clue as a child, the board game where someone gets killed and you try to figure out who was the murderer. And this year they came out with the Clue movie. And our kids all wanted to go, so one Friday night the three of them went, and I didn't think anything of it. I hadn't seen the movie, I knew the game, and it just, you know, it just wasn't a conscious thing on my part at that time. They came home and I was tucking the 8-year-old into bed, turned out the light, and he said, gee, Mom, you got to see that movie. It was really good, and there weren't any swears in it either. You'd like it. And I said, no swears, just murder. And he said, yeah. And I walked out of the room, and I thought, now what kind of message have I given this kid? He knows I don't approve of swearing, but apparently he thinks I condone murder and would enjoy it. And it's just so subtle. Come down real hard, you know, don't say bad words, but who cares if Mrs. Peacock got murdered in the library? That's okay.
with
the lead pipe. I don't know, it's hard, and you've got to be on top of it all the time, but the best way is to to be thinking about it, so you pick up on those things, I guess, and can comment on them. Because the issue with our kids and the guns at Christmas with their cousins, our children, when those two cousins came in the door, our kids, just their eyes just got huge.
We've been raided.
Yeah, all day they were trying to find ways to get the guns, hide the guns. And it was really true. These boys were aggressive. You know, whenever they had these guns, they were zipping all over the place and chasing them. And it does promote that type of atmosphere.
Yeah, I hate to be a Scrooge on Christmas, but in interest of argument, I'd like to say something on the other side. This talk about toys and not buying and stuff strikes me somewhat as a book burning of some type. If you have somebody that doesn't agree with your opinion and the parent can't control their children, so rather than look at themselves and how they can improve their parenting, they blame it on those toys that they're buying. And that they blame it on toys and companies. I used to play with guns a lot, and I'm by no means an aggressive fighter. I hate war. I have never been in a fight, anything like that. I used them, and they were very creative toys for me. I didn't have anybody to play with. I was an only child. So I pretended I was Custer or George Washington, and learned a lot, and experienced a lot. And it was a very learning experience, and, you know, I don't think that a kid picks up a gun and suddenly wants to kill the world. That can be. But my parents' attitude was, they just kind of let me play, and they smiled, and they let me do what I wanted to do. And then they always showed me that war was not right, and that was just accepted in our house, and we knew that. So I don't, it's apparent, I think it's more parenting than it is the materials. And we're looking beyond, trying to blame other things.
Do you want to react to that?
Yeah, I have, just as a mother of three boys, I've gone through those thoughts and been very concerned. I don't know whether to go or and have learned to understand what you're saying somewhat, and have struggled with these issues a great deal. And I guess I wanted to make a few comments on what we found most successful with our boys. We've come to the conclusion that boys play with guns. They do. They make them if you don't give them to them. And what we've done that has worked the best, and I'm not saying that we're perfect on these issues, is to say, we won't buy you war toys. If you really want a war toy, you can save up and buy it on your own. And that shows the children that we don't approve of them. But it doesn't give them this total ban, which then they can rebel against and become war toy crazy, which I have seen among little kids. And I sense this in our own boys, that if we had an absolute prohibition against certain toys, it makes them want them more and crave them, and they become more important. And I think that works a lot better with kids. And as my boys get older and I feel less power over what they think, the thing that I've come to think works the best with them, rather than saying, you can't read these books, you can't play with these toys, you can't go to the child's house who has a taped, one of our closest neighbor has a taped version of Rambo, and I know what you're saying. He sits down and watches it every other day. It makes me feel physically ill. We draw certain limits and say, you cannot be at his house when he plays this thing. But then instead of always saying, well, you cannot play with this boy, we try to give the boys a lot of alternatives. And I think that's a real place where the church can come into play. In our church, we have a library that the kids browse before and after church, and there are a lot of peace books on the shelves, so that the kids have this constant exposure. There are a lot of social activities that the kids can become involved in, like soup kitchen, which teaches them cooperation and concern for people who don't have as much. Our Sunday school has had slideshows on, I think it was called Loving the Stranger. And it was a slideshow on the Soviet Union showing that these people were like us. They look like us, they think like us. And I think that if we provide our kids with these positive alternatives, that may be more significant than always trying to ban the negative, just because I don't think banning the negative works, although those things make me as irritated as anyone here. Another comment that I've read is that the kids who are most afraid of dying in nuclear war are the ones whose parents feel the least powerful. And the parents who involve their children in peacemaking activities are less afraid of nuclear war. So I think that's another reason to involve kids in these activities right from the start. But I wonder if there are other ideas on how the church can promote activities. Holden is a good activity in itself. Just bringing kids here is a lot better than maybe taking them to a place there where they would have more violent play. And I'm sure there are other things that the church can, that churches, our churches can do to promote peaceful activities among kids.
Yeah, I would agree completely with what you're saying, because I know a friend of mine who's a bit younger than me, he's the son of a professor of theology at St. Lutheran Theological Seminary, and if anyone has been into guns and weapons and mercenary killing and total, complete cutting off of oneself from violence and just having absolutely no feelings about hurting someone, it's him. And his parents had told him, you know, we will not allow any of that sort of thing in the house. And he's got an incredible collection of stuff under his bed and in his closets and just hidden away in certain ways where it can't be found. And it's just built up in him as a means of rebellion. And I think it's the most dangerous kind of rebellion. And because he's seriously devoted his life to it now. And so I see where the danger comes. I think also that what John is saying is true, that you have to give them a little bit of a chance, but I also object to what John is saying, that it doesn't harm him, because one of the most important things is that violence has changed in the last few years. The violence that you pretended at, such as Custer in Washington, and maybe cowboys and Indians, was a different kind of war than the war that children play at now. The war that children play at now is they like to pretend to be terrorists and mercenaries, and it's a total kind of unfeeling war. It's a war for yourself, and it's survival, and it's you against everyone else. And it's not the kind of thing where you fight in an army or you fight for a cause. The only cause that you fight for is just this general idea of anti-communism. And that's exactly the way that these kids are feeling. It's not just one person anymore. I mean, many, many people have gotten into this. And it is extremely dangerous. But you have to be allowing, in at least somewhat, to both allow them to experience these toys, and then to, one, tell them that you don't approve, and two, explain to them that this is not real life. And that is really important, that they understand that what they're playing at, while they think it's fun, if they start to get the impression that it's real life, then that's when it gets really dangerous.
But how do they tell the difference? I mean, after a while, what is the difference between real life and real violence?
That's the danger, is that when they get too into it, so that they think that it's real life, that's the danger. So the parents need to be present in this play experience, so that if it's just like what John says, you know, playing with guns here and there, pretending it's Custer in Washington, that's okay. But when they start to think that they are Rambo and going out and killing Vietnamese soldiers, it gets really dangerous. So
I think that's the point. You can't
control on it.
Yeah, you can't just forbid it without being involved. You've got to also then provide alternate activities and exposure to other cultures and to social action sorts of things that epitomize what we want them to cultivate. And you can't just make rules and then sit back and send them out to play. You do have to be involved.
I think that we need to learn to speak our opinions more to our kids too. And I think, for example, as we get older and less afraid of our own embarrassment, walking down a grocery store aisle and seeing that cereal and saying really loud to your kids, that cereal is horrible. That should have never been made. Isn't that awful? And then all the people turn around and say, and I bet maybe half of the mothers that listen to you would say, you might start that person thinking, yeah, that is crazy. Your kids might think that you're crazy too. But you're not saying it. You're not saying to them, you cannot buy this cereal because it's horrible. You're just saying, your mom is a little bit of a kook, but this is what she thinks. She thinks that's horrible. And the child then at least has something to think about. I wanted to comment on this other man's comment too. The toys now that are so horrible, in my mind, are the ones that have nuclear weapons. I cannot understand how anyone could make these, but a lot of the toys now have missiles. And I think it's totally allowable, whatever. I mean, when we say that if our kids buy those toys with their own money, they throw away the weapons. And I think that kids can understand that there are some weapons that you don't even play with, that you don't even think about using, and those are these weapons of ultimate destruction. That's real hard to deal with young kids, but I think we need to face that issue.
Question in another vein, you, those that are parents here can respond, but what are some creative alternatives to disciplining your children without resorting to physical striking, that kind of thing? I mean, I have a few ideas myself too, but I was wondering what other people thought might be some creative things that work for them. And
I babysat for a woman who I just thought have quite a bit of admiration for. And when her kids were little, she used the timeout method in their room, and the room was filled with toys, but the whole idea of being by themselves, and there were three of them within like 3 years, kids, a couple through adoption. And so she'd say, Stephen, go to your room. And Stephen would march up and he'd yell, I don't want to be in my room by myself. And that was his punishment. You know, she never struck him. But the whole idea of being by himself and being in timeout. And, you know, and she'd say, Stephen, when you can tell Michael you're sorry for hitting Michael, you can come out and tell him that. And you can't until you're ready. And he'd sit in there for hours because he didn't want to do that. He'd yell and he'd scream, and the toys didn't amuse him because he was in, and he was thinking, I don't want to talk to Michael. I don't want to apologize. But he finally came out and he'd have to do it and mean it in order to go through playing again. And I just thought that was creative in that, she never struck any of her children, and yet they all knew that timeout was awful punishment, and they were supposed to think about why they were being punished and somehow resolve that.
That's the way I was raised, and I was supposed to come out and apologize to my sister. And I came out 3 times. My mother sent me back in because she knew I wasn't honest about it. Well, the same time, finally.
Come to three.
Three one, or four or five, sometimes two, 10.
And you know the third one that they haven't done it, it works. Although you better make sure that if you get to three, you do it.
What?
Strike. There are times when it needs to be done.
I don't
reaction
like
to that.
I don't like to see parents yell and yell and yell. But for us, with a 1.5-year-old, a combination of a sharp noise and a clap startles him just as much as that clap against his rear. I mean, it's a quick thing that's just my hand against my hand. No violence involved.
I really liked the whole notion of natural and logical consequences in disciplining. The punishment fits the offense, and you know, if it's that you, I can't even think of them anymore. You know, if you really messed up the playroom, you have to clean it up before you can do anything else. You know, and that's not necessarily punishment, that's asking for responsible behavior in response to irresponsible behavior. And again, though, you know, it's kind of like when you're thinking about anger, when it can be a response rather than a reaction. Because a lot of times my reaction is to
What she's talking about, I don't know how many people know, Rudolf Dreikers wrote a book called Logical Consequences.
Children's Challenge.
Well, there's the logical consequences too. Okay. It focuses just on this method.
Raising responsible child is another one that comes out of the same school of thought that I think it's
and systematic training for effective parenting also talks about those consequences.
Basically, it's a lot of Adlerian psychology.
It is. Another thing that works too is the loss of privileges. You don't put your bike in the garage, and you don't ride your bike in the garage.
That's the logical consequence. They know ahead of time, and now it's your choice. If you choose to follow the rules.
And you don't string it out forever.
Right. One last question. I think we need to wrap it up. Is there one last one?
Okay. What's the things, I guess? Boys Town seems to take care of kids, and they've got real problem kids without striking them. I'm not sure what to do with it. That's number one. And number two is, if you're teaching your kids nonviolence, what are you teaching about in the playground when some bully does pick on them? Do you teach them to just be beat up, or do you teach them to fight back? Just how do they want your child to handle?
My approach to that has always been, those are the people you stay away from.
It's not always possible. You get caught in a restroom or on the playground. Somewhere.
Yeah, you're right. But I think the bully needs to experience the consequences of his actions, the natural kind of consequences, and that is that he's driving people away from him. And eventually he'll have no friends and be very lonely. I don't think that we can say beating somebody up back is a justifiable reaction to a behavior that we don't like.
So you teach your kids not to get back?
I say, yeah, if it hurts, stay away from them. You'll get hurt again. Avoid that person, do everything you can to not get close in case you get hurt.
I think, again, the parents have to be really supportive of that, and it's got to be something that's communication has to be built in the whole time. When I was in sixth grade, I moved from Chicago to California, and was kind of the odd person out, and got beat up quite a bit. And my mom was just really supportive of, that's not a good thing to do. The communication was great. And I think the talking was what was so important, and the fact that I was supported at home, even though it was hard at school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think it's real important for us to consider alternatives, and I also think it's very important for us to take a look at ways in which we can wage peace at home as well as in the world. And maybe there are some economic sanctions that we can exercise at the movie theater or at the toy store or at the grocery store or other kinds of alternative things for bringing peace to the entire world. Merry Christmas, everybody.